The phenomenon can be studied with greater clearness in a nation of Catholic culture than in a nation of non-Catholic. Thus in England, the Protestantism, which has been the homogeneous culture of the nation for over 200 years, so permeates the national literature, history and attitude towards all political problems, that it has become difficult to distinguish it from citizenship. I have seen historical textbooks which are little more than anti-Catholic propaganda, the late Mr. Bright Saint, for instance, and Mr. Trevelyan Saint, used currently in Catholic schools. The national Protestant legend is paramount. In Italy and France it is not so. There is there a very clear-cut distinction between the tendency which subordinates all education towards national ideal and that which puts the religious ideal first. There is not only a distinction, there is conflict. This religion of nationalism is supplemented by the character of modern governments, and we discover that, throughout Europe, governments, whether parliamentary, and therefore oligarchic and plutocratic, as in France and England, or monarchical, and therefore popular, as in Poland, Spain and Italy, are either anti-Catholic at the worst, or, when they are sympathetic with the Church, quite external to her and capable on any occasion of hostility. Now, these governments or those behind them who speak through them have the executive in their hands, the police and the courts of law. It is therefore essential in any study of the political circumstance in which the Church stands to date to admit a consideration of the attitude of the various governments towards it. We have all observed since the war the effect produced by the releasing of some Catholic peoples, notably the Poles and the Irish, and the increase of power in others, notably Italy. On that side the Church has been greatly strengthened. But governments are not the same things as peoples. Governments are, under a dictatorship, the instruments of popular feeling, and even in parliamentary countries they are, though really the servants of the wealthy, nominally the spokesmen of the populace, however weak their title to such spokesmanship may be. But in neither case are they the people. And however Catholic a people, it will hardly, today, have a Catholic government. Further, the strength of governments is still considerable. It is no longer as great as the strength of finance, and it is more efficacious in one country than in another. For instance, government is far stronger and of more effect on the national fate in Italy than in France, for the Italians admire and support their highly personal form of government, and obey it. The French despise their parliamentarians, and obey them as little as possible. But everywhere government makes a great difference, and the attitude of government, for or against the Catholic Church, is a first-class political moment. To a great many people the mere suggestion that a modern government may be for or against the Catholic Church sounds nonsense. The forms of modern government mask its character, and the fashion of our day is in favor of a pretended neutrality in the matter of religion. Moreover, it is perfectly true that until the fashion changes you will have neither overt persecution of the Church nor, for that matter, overt establishment of it. Thus, the Masonic government at Prague, in its most anti-Catholic moment, strongly supported an attempted schism within the body of the Church in Bohemia, but it dared not, in its desire to conform with its own liberal formula, actually attack the Church as such. It could not forbid her services or the practice of the faithful. The only government so to act has been that of Mexico, and even there some sort of pretext was advanced, not religious, but political. On the other hand, Poland, as we have seen, when upon the point of declaring Catholicism the established religion of the country, also felt the influence of our current religious conventions, avoided the issue, and did not confirm that establishment. But though there was no overt declaration of hostility, the governments of the world can nonetheless be classed as upon the whole opposed to the influence of the Catholic Church. This character can be seen more in their indirect effects than in any other fashion. The hostility is hardly ever, save in such extreme cases as Mexico, to be discovered in the active suppression of the faith. It is to be seen in the discountenancing of Catholic immigration, in the spirit wherewith educational laws are administered, and even in the diplomatic treatment of foreign nations. Thus there is no doubt that the political sympathy in England and America with Prussia after the war, the saving at Versailles by the English and American delegates of the unnatural rule of Prussia over the Catholic West of Germany, the dismemberment of Austria, the denial to the Hungarians of their natural prince. All these were the products of religious sympathy and antipathy. The outcry against the occupation of the Ruhr and against the establishment of a Rhenish state were other examples. But that point in the world where you see the thing under the strongest light is Paris. It is the attitude of a French government towards the Catholic Church, which is of most effect at the present moment upon the political side of that church, Saint Fortunes. This is because the French people are themselves so strongly divided between clerical and anti-clerical, because the organization of the state in France is so military and mechanical, and because national feeling is perhaps more intense among the French, in spite of their divisions, than among any other people. Two factors are of especial prominence in lending to the attitude of the French government towards the Church such high importance today. The first is the French influence upon the whole world through a mixture of lucidity and energy in thought, phrase and action. The second is the central physical position held by France. This last is but a geographical factor and therefore only a material one, but it has its weight. When you read a good French newspaper upon the affairs of Europe, you feel as though you were standing upon a hilltop and looking down upon a plain all about you. Paris is equally interested in London, Berlin, Rome, Prague, Warsaw, Vienna, Madrid and New York, and the lines radiating from that central point to the others are lines of moral communication, the patterns of which upon the map are a symbol of that central station, with all its influence of centrality. French government has been opposed to Catholicism for 50 years. There have been moments when the opposition has been more intense, there have been moments when it has been relaxed, but government upon the whole favorable to Catholic influence has not been present in the Republic since the fall of MacMahon in 1877. A highly organized clique, largely Masonic, then captured the electoral machine and has kept it ever since. It has often been said, and quite truly, that this state of affairs does not reflect the French people. The French government is, less than that of any other people, the expression of national feeling. The system by which professional politicians whom everyone despises share in rotation the perquisites of their trade is disgusting to the nation at large, but it is so fluid a system that it is most difficult to destroy. It was nearly destroyed in the late 80s of the last century. Had the Great War been short and successful, it would have been destroyed at once. It was all but destroyed in the July of 1926 when mobs began gathering to throw the professional politicians of the Parliament House into the street. But the thing has never come off, and meanwhile the clique in power remains still anti-Catholic in tone and direction. There is an extreme case. In Belgium, in Italy, in Spain, the tendency is other. But it still remains true that even in the Catholic culture and as a matter of course in the Protestant, governments are, as supplements to nationalism, out of step with the spirit of the Church. This material strength of governments, coupled with and supporting the far more important effect of nationalism as a spiritual power, forms everywhere an obstacle to full Catholic life. It remains to discuss whether this exceptional contemporary force of nationalism, of the state as an object of worship to the exclusion of, or at any rate, far superior to, any other object of worship, is long to remain. May we say that there are forces already apparent tending to its decline? Can we reasonably forecast the coming of a decline in nationalism during the near future? Of course, in the long run such forces must appear, because all human moods are mortal, nationalism like the rest. But are the tendencies present today so that we can watch them? And are there, besides these, contemporary conditions which point to a future hostility to nationalism? I think there are. Besides the Catholic Church, there are at least two great international forces, not to quote more, which are already clearly apparent. One is that of finance, the other is that of the protest of the proletariat against capitalism, a protest which in its most lucid and most logical form is called communism. Both these act as solvents to that religion of nationality which was universal before the Great War. These two forces, international finance and international socialism, act after fashions often unexpected, and the more drastic. For instance, The big newspapers and nearly all the press of large circulation is purely capitalist, a mere propaganda agent for capitalism. Bang the nationalist drum as hard as they can, even to deafening and to weariness. But that exaggerated nationalism of theirs more and more loses its effect through a manifest insincerity due to their unconcealable anxiety for big business. They have to bawl nationalism at the top of their vulgar voices because circulation demands that theme, but they are compelled, in the interest of their millionaire owners, to preach goodwill for capitalist enterprises interlocked throughout the world. They may, for instance, demand a special British policy in the matter of oil, but they will not oppose the interest of American oil or Dutch. They may roar for reparations, but they won't roar against the ultimate transfer of reparations to the international bondholder. As for the banks, they are almost openly international today. One can no longer speak of any country as having a national financial policy. Some are more particularist than others, notably France and Italy, but all respond to the pull of New York. And here, in England, the banking system is but a branch of New York Saint, to which it is voluntarily but also necessarily bound. But the wave of nationalism will rise higher before it declines, for there is one element which tends to preserve it, and that is the nobility of the ideal presented. Here we have a situation quite different from that which applies to our other enemies, such as anti-clericalism and the rest. They excite no enthusiasm, they prey upon the baser part of man, and actually warn the isolated and the ignorant against an elevation of spirit. But nationalism has running through it the ardent character of devotion. That is its glory, and that is also what renders it a peril. The effect of socialism logically, communism as a solvent of nationalism, is far less strong, partly because it is an inhuman ideal not possible in practice, as everyone knows at heart, even those who proclaim its ideal loudest, and more because it is sporadic and partial. It can only flourish where there is an industrial proletariat. It cannot convert the bulk even of this, and even should it succeed in doing so, these industrial proletarians are patchy. If you were to take a map and set down on it the industrial areas of the world, you would have something like a rather disjointed rash, nothing homogeneous, while of single nations, England, which is by temperament the least inclined to communism, is the only completely industrialized of them all. Communism will increase. It will increase greatly. It will not affect national separateness as finance will affect it, but the combined effect of proletariat and banker will be formidable. To anti-clericalism, I come in this section to a factor in the main opposition which has a character of its own, markedly different from all others, the factor of anti-clericalism. It is of special importance to emphasize, to define and to explain it to an audience of English and American readers, because it does not come into their daily lives. They have no direct experience of it. It is important to emphasize it lest an essential part of the Church-Saint conflict today should be overlooked, to define it because it is perpetually confused with anti-Catholicism in general, with wholesale rancor against religion and with the spirit of persecution at large, to explain it because until we understand its nature, we cannot follow the process whereby its votaries have become ally to the massive moods combined against the Catholic Church, and have by now almost dissolved into that mass, no longer maintaining their original character. Anti-clericalism may, in the near future, indirectly affect the condition of Catholics even where they are in a minority amid Protestant surroundings, and it is well to be ready with an understanding of it before that happens. The subject, I say, must be emphasized because of its unfamiliarity outside the nations of Catholic tradition. The ancient Catholic culture reacts towards the Church and the Church towards it in a very different fashion from that which we find in the area of Protestantism. Nothing is more startling, or, indeed, less comprehensible, to the average Catholic who has lived all his life as the citizen of an essentially Protestant state and under the surrounding atmosphere of the Protestant culture, than this principal phenomenon in the nations of Catholic culture. It is not too much to say that the Catholic belonging to a nation of Protestant culture feels this form of the quarrel between the Church and the world, anti-clericalism, to be more alien to him than any other product of any social spirit foreign to his own. As a rule, he does not know what it is all about. It either seems to him mere blind hate which no explanation can make intelligible, or he confuses it with that general hostility to Catholicism in his own world of which all are in some degree aware, and many, especially converts, have experienced very gravely? If this be the reason for emphasizing anti-clericalism as a modern force, how shall it be defined? Anti-clericalism may be defined as the spirit which is goaded into activity by the invasion of the civil province by clerical agency. That is the minimum definition, that is the definition of the thing in its origin and before it entered into alliance with the enemies of the faith. Saint Louis can be quoted as anti-clerical when he refused the French bishops the right to seize the goods of excommunicated people. The Irish leaders can be quoted as anti-clerical when they refused to be restrained in their land policy and political program by certain of the hierarchy and even by the advice of the Pope. Their picturesque phrase, "We will take our religion from Rome but our politics from hell," is anti-clerical. In this minimum sense, anti-clericalism is always potentially present in the mass of a Catholic civilization and may be excited at any moment without reference to doctrine or to the general acceptance of Catholic ideas and morals as a whole. The more legitimate protests which preceded the Reformation were essentially anti-clerical and a good example of the peril that spirit involves. The irritation caused in England by excessive church taxation, the exasperation of pre-Reformation London in particular with mortuary dues and their irrational incidents, are examples of anti-clericalism in action. The great upheaval which followed in Germany started essentially as an anti-clerical thing which preceded and provoked the subsequent doctrinal chaos. Anti-clericalism then, may appear at any moment in any place where the Church fills society, and is as probable a feature of the future as of the past. But the anti-clericalism of which we speak today is something far exceeding this minimum definition. It has risen to be a chief force antagonistic to Catholicism as a whole, and it is with that force we are here concerned. That force is universally present in the societies which maintained or recovered the faith after the great storm of the 16th century. It varies in degree with time and place. Governments now support it, now oppose it, but it is everywhere present, in Belgium, in Spain, in France, in Portugal, in Italy. It might at any moment acquire a renewed power in any one of these countries, as for that matter in Poland itself, or even in Ireland. In what was for long the leader of the Catholic culture, in France, it is particularly powerful and has held the levers of the governmental machine for nearly a lifetime, with effects of the most profound sort, which are only today beginning to show their final fruit. It was all-powerful in Italy until quite recently, it dominated Belgium until half a lifetime ago, and may at any moment now recover a majority there at the elections. It has had bouts of revolutionary power in Spain, and just before the war provoked something like a revolution, with difficulty suppressed, in Catalonia. What is this contemporary hostile force in the concrete today? What is this social and political agent now called anti-clericalism, so absent from the nations of Protestant culture that they cannot conceive its nature, so familiar to the nations of the old Catholic culture that they take it for granted, and that its opponents, while fighting it to the death, comprehend it as familiarly as they do their own position, feeling profoundly in themselves the emotions from which it has proceeded? We must explain it to understand it. Anti-clericalism of this present kind derives no longer from a protest against extravagant clerical action, but from a conflict between two incompatible theories of the state, the Catholic and the neutral, or lay. It is essentially a product of the universality of the Church and of its admitted power in a Catholic country, coupled with the recognition of the truth so unpalatable to most men today, and especially to those of the Protestant culture, that the Catholic Church must either rule society or be ruled in her own despite. It is not because the Catholic discipline is so strong, it is not because the Catholic scheme has developed for so many centuries into so highly organized a thing, that the present anti-clericalism has arisen. These elements of strength in the Catholic position act, of course, as irritants to the opponents of the faith, but they are not the main roots of the anti-clericalism. Such anti-clericalism proceeds, I repeat, from a recognition in the Catholic quite as much as in his opponent, that Catholic life is not normal to a society unless Catholic morals and doctrine be supreme therein, unless the morals of the faith appear fully in the laws of that society, unless it be the established and authoritative religion of that society, the Church is ill at ease. In other words, and to put it as plainly as possible, the Catholic Church is not a sect, and will never be able to regard itself as a sect, or to accept what is to her the fiction, yet to others in non-Catholic countries a truism, that she is a sect. The fiction that the Catholic Church is a sect, like any of the various bodies around it in nations of Protestant culture, that she is a sect, like the Mormons, or the Baptists, or the Quakers, is nourished by a score of conventions, by that false phrase, the churches, by the offensive adjunct, Roman, as though the faith were but one fashion in 100 Catholicisms, or as if Catholicism were a thing split into numerous factions, of Rome, Canterbury, Boston and Timbuktu. Yet the falsehood is so firmly fixed and so long established here that it has recently begun to affect the Catholic body itself. The position is half accepted by them, though in their hearts they know that it is a lie. For the line of cleavage does not fall between the various groups, Catholic, agnostic, evangelical, or whatnot, but between the Catholic Church and all else. She is unique, and at issue with the world. She proposes to take in men's ain't minds even more than a place taken by patriotism, to influence the whole of society, not a part of it, and to influence it even more thoroughly than a common language. Where she is confronted by any agency inimical to her claim, though the agency be not directly hostile, she cannot but oppose it. She denounces such laws as impose universal instruction upon Catholic children by force and forbid that instruction to be explicitly Catholic, as permit divorce, as license foul art, as favor contraception or the mutilation of the deficient. She does not admit the thesis that legislation and executive action, in her eyes immoral, is no concern of hers, that in this Christendom which she made she is to tolerate by silence and acquiescence what is damnable. Hence the prodigious quarrel. Hence the fact, for it is a fact that she lies suspect throughout the Protestant culture, and that throughout the whole area of Catholic culture are present in varying degrees the elements of religious war. Remark the inevitable effect of the Church Saint claim to authority through an absolute possession of the truth upon two kinds of men in such a society of Catholic culture. First, upon those who are in personal practice Catholic but who have become attached to the idea of state neutrality. Second, upon those who, starting with no special hostility against Catholicism, are yet not Catholics in belief or practice. The first sort admit the claims of the Church in a homogeneous Catholic society. If all were Catholic, they would have no objection to the establishment of the Church, to her control of education, and so forth. Such a society is their ideal. But as it is not achieved, as large bodies, even in nations of the Catholic culture, are, by this time, indifferent or hostile to Catholicism, they are led into the solution of neutrality. They regard the effort, for instance, of the Church to obtain state Catholic teaching for Catholic children as an invasion of state rights. They became anti-clerical. Many such have I known in Catholic countries, especially among the wealthier classes which had caught the liberal air of the 19th century from university and press. With the second sort, those who are not Catholic in their private lives, the effect is far stronger. Judge the effect of the Church Saint claim upon a group of citizens who do not admit those claims, and who are numerous or powerful enough to withstand them. It needs, at the outset, no special malice upon their part, nor, originally, any conscious hatred of the faith, to arouse them at once to action against demands which cannot seem to them abominably extravagant. Think what you like, they say, and even within certain limits act as you like, but allow others who are not of your kind a similar freedom. Be content with a common system of morals applied in common law, and for the rest, treat your particular doctrines as the private affair of your individual members. Do not propose to identify yourself with the state, or to demand the support of the state, as of right, not only for your protection, but against the efforts of others, your opponents. What could be more reasonable, or more natural, or more obvious, to men steeped in the idea that religion is a matter of opinion, and that all men are now so hopelessly divided upon it that unity is neither possible nor desirable? To which the Church replies, the fallacy in your contention, the flaw in its logic, lies in your presumption of a common system of morals applied in a common law. There is no such thing. There is no common system of morals. There is system A, system B, system C, and so on, indefinitely. The Catholic system of morals is the only one by which mankind can live as it should live. It is the only one under which men are normal and, so far as the word can apply to a fallen race, reasonably happy. It is the system by which your society was made and to which it owes allegiance. Your laws will be founded upon your morals, and where those morals are not Catholic, they will be anti-Catholic. It is inevitable. You say that part of your common morals is monogamy. You got that from me. You cannot pretend that it is universal to the human race, and observe that, as you abandon me, you are becoming more changeable upon it. The more you depart from my own special standard therein, the more you break up that tradition of society by which we have all hitherto lived. It is the same with the doctrine of property. It is the same with the doctrine of future reward and punishment for good and evil deeds done on earth. It is the same with the institution of the family, with the authority of parents over their children and of the older over the younger generation. Where my authoritative voice is not supreme, there you are in conflict with myself, with me, who made Christendom. Such is the Church's reply, and to the anti-Catholic it is monstrous. Starting from this original contradiction, the antagonism between the two positions becomes rapidly embittered. The anti-clerical says, "Since you will not live at peace with your neighbors, we must dominate you. You shall accept our schools. We guarantee they shall in no way offend your particular tenets, but on the other hand we will give these no countenance nor even mention them. The children shall not be told that the presence in the sacrament is a fairy tale, nor given lesson on the beauty of divorce, nor even warned against the evils of your own intolerance, but on the other hand we will not teach an item of your doctrines. We will teach reading, writing and arithmetic, history in terms of humanity and patriotism, doctrines on which all are agreed. In private you may add to that as much as you will, but that is all we shall do. Our system of state morals, our laws of the moment, we will impose upon you. If you do not like them, so much the worse for your rebellion. If we change them more and more in a direction opposed to your views, that is our affair, and you must submit." The Catholic Church answers again, "With every step you take you show yourself more clearly hostile. In the name of neutrality you leave even the mention of God out of your system of education. You are already destroying marriage. Tomorrow you will probably begin to destroy property, not as fools think, to the advantage of the many, but to the advantage of a few rich and to the enslavement of the rest. In acting thus you are destroying society itself. I intend to oppose you tenaciously, with all my power, and at the first opportunity to counterattack and reverse your slow murder of Christendom." Here you have a situation which could never arise save in a society the great mass of which still preserved Catholic tradition, and in which the claim of the Catholic Church to impose its influence was still so much a matter of practical politics that resistance to such a claim was felt to be defense against an active peril. Here you have the issue between anti-clericalism as we know it today in the Church. I will examine the consequences which have come of this and have made of anti-clericalism so dangerous an opponent today. The battle being set between the two irreconcilable policies, the one which presupposes a universal Catholic scheme, the other which presupposes a neutral or lay state, with the Catholic Church relegated to the position of a private corporation, certain consequences follow which the original authors of anti-clericalism never intended. The first of these concerns the institution of monasticism. In theory, the anti-clerical should leave the religious orders of men and women to go their own way. I do not say that the anti-Catholic should do so in theory. He, of course, by his every principle is led to the destruction of an institution which is so essential a support of Catholicism. The anti-clerical soon becomes the anti-Catholic, no doubt. It is a process I will later describe. But for the moment I point out that in theory, by his own declaration, the anti-clerical in his liberalism and in his passion for the neutral state should leave monks and nuns alone. If he likes them, it will be his pleasant duty to do so. If he dislikes them, his painful duty, but, either way, his duty. The religious are members of private corporations, acting privately after their own fashion, and so long as they don't force anyone to join them or constrain their members by violence, the state has no concern with them one way or another. But the religious orders which teach influence a great body of the growing generation and form the minds of these into a mold different from that which the state is imposing through its schools. Their zeal extends the area of their educational action, their corporate wealth and devotion, their self-sacrifice and independence of financial reward, create a concrete competition against the neutral state schools. If the process continues, the state will be paralyzed, its effort to dominate the church will be turned in flank. The teaching religious orders are suppressed. But when you suppress a religious order, you have the opportunity to loot its property. Under the oligarchic parliamentary system strangely called democracy, the loot will go into the pockets of the politicians, the lawyers, and the hangers-on of both. This first taste of loot breeds an increasing appetite. Religious orders which had nothing to do with teaching, which were merely contemplative, are driven out. The Carthusians, for instance, from their mountain home, and some hundreds of thousands of pounds more are poured into the pockets of the parliamentarians, their relatives, their legal connections and other hangers-on. At last you get an established principle that monasteries and convents are to be looted wholesale, their property taken from them and their members dispersed or, if they will not disperse, exiled. Monks and nuns are put out of the common law. They may not own with the same security as other men and women. They may not associate. That is how the thing ends, a gross violation of the most fundamental principle in which the liberalism of the anti-clerical was, at first, rooted. More follows. A tendency to forbid the public employment of men avowedly Catholic increases. It begins with a complaint against this man or that. The principle is stated that public money should not go to those who will accept the state system. Under the guise of neutrality, individual persecution appears and grows. But there is much more to come. Within the state are not only the original authors of protest against Catholic claims to authority, the original sincere theorists who acted without malice or hatred upon what seemed to them an obviously just and simple conception of civic rights, but numbers who are by tradition positively and even violently hostile to the faith, and who desired to destroy it. Such are men who have come to associate Catholicism with opposition to some cherished ideal, as of republicanism, or of the nation. The French republicans remember their quarrel with the clergy in the moment of royalist invasion a century ago, the Italian patriots the sympathy of priests with Austria. Such are, in one nation, some large minority of dissidents, who have suffered from disabilities in the past when the church was supported by the civil authority, who have retained great wealth, and who are ready to destroy that which they have always opposed to the best of their ability. The French Huguenots are of this kind hardly a 20th of the nation, but controlling perhaps a third of its available liquid capital.